If you love astronomy, there is great news. In 2006, as you remember, Pluto was downgraded from a planet to a planetoid, or a dwarf planet. Now, to me, that doesn't make sense, because Pluto has been a planet since 1930, when Clyde Tombaugh, a former farmer, turned astronomer, and he's got a very interesting life. You want to read a story that's very interesting, read about Clyde Tombaugh. He was a farmer, and he would use mules to haul supplies to the observatory. And he got a job doing that, and he convinced the staff to let him stay on and help. He had built a telescope when he was younger and was very interested in astronomy, knew all about it. So they hired him to work as a staff member. Later on, he got his college degrees, and he discovered Pluto. And the way he discovered Pluto is Neptune and Uranus were orbiting in a very strange manner. So they knew that something outside of the orbit of Uranus and Pluto, Uranus and Neptune, was modifying their orbit and throwing it out of alignment. So they said, there's a planet out there, and we don't know exactly where it is. So Clyde Tombaugh was given the job of figuring out a way to find it. So he used a very easy method. What he did is he took pictures of the night sky, the stars, and the next day later he'd take a picture of the same part of the sky. And then he would put them next to each other and put a piece of paper between them, and he would look at both of them, and he would notice his eye would catch which star had moved. So once he figured out by taking thousands of pictures that one of the stars had moved, he figured that was a planet. And then they trained their telescopes on that part of the sky, and lo and behold, there was Pluto with its satellite. So that's how he discovered Pluto. But anyway, they downgraded Pluto to a dwarf planet. So we no longer have a ninth planet, but there is a possibility that we have another ninth planet on the horizon. And this is good news for all of those who are interested in astronomy. A couple of Caltech researchers named Mike Brown. Now, Mike Brown is one of the discoverers of this new ninth planet. He was the one that demoted Pluto. He was the one that led the motion and the movement to demote Pluto from a planet to a planetoid. And he's the one that has discovered this ninth planet. Well, Mike Brown, a researcher at Caltech, and his partner, Konstantin Batygin, were looking at the orbit of some objects that lay way out in the outer edges of the solar system. They were looking at comets and asteroids. They appear as little bitty dots to the human eye, these faraway objects. And they looked at the comets, and they noticed that if you look into the comets, and you had the sun here, all the comets were on one side of the sun. So something over here had to be moving them to the other side of the sun, the gravitational force. And so what they believe, is they have found the ninth planet. Now, by observing where the other orbits are, they have pinpointed where they think the planet is, although no one has actually seen it. So they've told the telescope astronomers, the ones that use telescopes, where to point their telescopes. And they say that probably in the next couple of months, after they do a survey of the sky, they're probably going to find this ninth planet. They're pretty sure they are. Let me read you what it says here out of the Caltech University website when I went on to look at it. It says this about the discovery. The researchers, Konstantin Batygin and Mike Brown, discovered the planet's existence through mathematical modeling and computer simulation, but have not yet observed the object directly. In plain English, this means our computer models tell us there's a planet, but we haven't seen it. We know it's there, we just have not seen it through our telescopes. And they figured that the planet is about 9 times the diameter of the Earth, which puts it a little bit smaller than Neptune. And they estimate it takes about, because of the way it perturbs the orbits of these other things, it takes about 15,000 years to orbit the sun. Pluto takes about 200 or 300. This one takes about 15,000. Because it is so far away, it has not been seen by any earthbound telescopes yet. But they know where it is. They are confident it will soon be discovered. Now, how did these two scientists know that this invisible planet existed? this planet no one has seen? Well, they used the following laws to surmise that this planet existed. They knew about the laws of physics and about the laws of light and radiation. They were experts in the laws of gravity. They knew where a body was supposed to be because of the gravity, and they looked at where it was, and they could even estimate the mass of the body and the gravity that was affecting the other planets, the other comets and asteroids, even though they hadn't seen it. So they were pretty well versed in the law of gravity and how various other astronomical bodies were moving. They were also very well versed in the laws of celestial mechanics and how things orbit and how things travel around the sun was discovered by our old friend Sir Isaac Newton back in the 1800s. Interestingly, this ninth planet is much like God. What do I mean by that? God is invisible, but that does not mean he does not exist. When any scientific field is examined, it becomes obvious that there is an invisible creator behind the concepts in that particular branch of science. For example, physics. We have natural forces that work together. They're balanced. They're unchangeable. They follow mathematical properties and laws. Chemistry, you have the pattern of the periodic table. You've got the elements, the neutron or the nucleus with the neutrons and the protons in it. So many energy levels above it is the first orbital shell for the first electrons, and they're all at certain specific intervals. And it looks like somebody has designed them that way. It's sort of like you come to an island and you wonder if the island is deserted. And you look and you see coconuts arranged in a certain order. That would tell you that there's some kind of intelligence there. Same thing that happens with the patterns inherent in the atomic structure of various elements. We look at biology, the design of the organic systems, and how complex they are. And as you get smaller and smaller, and you have microscopes that can see at higher and higher magnifications, so you're looking at a smaller area, the complexity increases. It doesn't get less, it gets more as you look at it smaller and smaller. All that we see in nature and science seem to be saying, I have been created, I have been designed, I just did not come into existence on my own. So what we can do is we can use the laws of science to discover what God is like, even though we have not seen him. Just like they haven't seen that ninth planet, and they know it's there, we know that there's a God by looking at the laws that govern the natural world. Now, one of the common fallacies is that the biblical creation goes against the laws of nature and science. Some people say, oh, the Bible and nature and science, they're not going to agree. And this is not true, because you have to remember that God is a creator of nature. God is a creator of the natural world. And man has interpreted nature, and on his interpretations of nature, he's developed all kinds of sciences. Science of biology, science of chemistry, science of physics, science of astronomy, science of cosmology, by looking at nature. So what does this mean? It means that the Bible, properly interpreted, and the laws of science are going to agree, because they have the same author. Now, if we let the evidence from science and nature take us where it will, then we will discover something very, very interesting. That's spoken about in the book of Romans. Let's go to Romans chapter 1. Romans chapter 1. You remember that planet that's invisible? Yet we know it's there because we can see what effect it's had on the other bodies that are orbiting outside the edges of the solar system. Notice what it says here in Romans chapter 1, verse 19. Because what may be known of God is manifested to them, as it should read, for God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. So God is like that ninth planet. We can see what he's like by examining nature, by examining the true sciences. Now let's review what we have looked at in the past two sermons. This is the third sermon in a series of four on evolution. We've covered two of them before. Let's look at what we learned in the first sermon. Very quickly, in the first sermon, we learned that scientists are biased. We also learned that we are not creation scientists. We are biblical creationists. Creation scientists believe that 6,000 years ago, everything came into existence. We don't believe that. We believe that there has been more than one catastrophe. Most people understand that the flood of Noah took place, destroyed the earth. We also understand that there was a catastrophe in Genesis chapter 1, verse 1 and 2. So we understand that there has been two catastrophes that have wrecked and ruined the earth. And we've also, in the first sermon, looked at the concept that evolution is not scientific. It violates many laws of science. And that is what we're going to look at actually in detail today. In the second sermon, which are biblical problems with evolution, we learn that evolutionists claim to be able to transcend the physical. They make statements about God and about the hereafter and about immortality and death that they have no business making because they don't know. They don't know. They just don't know about it because that's not their field of study. Evolutionists also say that there is no God, no Messiah, no Christ, no omnipotent being that we call God, that he doesn't exist. They also say that life is a natural process and that God is not involved, that life just kind of runs by itself. And we also show that evolution and the evolutionary teaching robs humanity of its potential. And that potential is for us to be not the end product of a bunch of evolutionary mechanisms and, you know, enjoy life because tomorrow when you die, that's all there is. That's not what we believe. We believe that we have been created to become sons of God, which is our human potential. So in those past two sermons, we've seen some interesting things. In this sermon, we are going to look at some of the scientific problems with the theory of evolution. The first one, and this is a biggie, is evolution cannot explain how life began. Now, if you ask an evolutionist how life began, they have all kinds of theories, but it usually goes something like this. We suppose that, or we surmise that in the distant past, or probably we feel that this occurred. Nothing concrete. They don't know. They're guessing. Some of the theories about how life began include the following. You know, life came from an asteroid. An asteroid hit the Earth. It brought some spores or some algae or some single-celled organisms in some kind of rock matrix. And when this rock broke up and these spores went all over the Earth and populated the Earth, and were the end result of all of those spores developing and evolving. Which kind of begs the question, because then you can ask yourself, evolutionists should ask themselves, well, yeah, but where did that life begin? Because it began somewhere. Second theory, and these are some I've looked up on the internet. These are not all of them. You know, that we came from extraterrestrial visitors. You know, thousands of years ago or millions of years ago or whatever date you want to pick. Spaceship landed, extraterrestrials got off and seeded the Earth through some process. Either left themselves or left organisms or took the organisms that were here and made them more intelligent or whatever. Remember the story, the movie 2001 A Space Odyssey? That was the whole thesis of the story. Once again, where did the extraterrestrials come from? They came from somewhere. Another one is they came from crystals. Life came from crystals. Crystals just sort of organize themselves into cells. Another one is that life began underwater near these thermal springs. You know, there's a lot of warm springs underneath that this hot water is coming up out of the Earth's surface, you know, the ground, the geothermal springs underground, and there's a lot of life forms that develop around there. Well, that some of the nutrients in the ocean and these warm water currents mixed together and life began. A newest one that's come out in the last couple of years is the clay theory. Probably even heard of that one. And that is that clay is an organic compound, and that the clay kind of organized itself into cells. And then we have the primordial organic soup concept. and there was a lot of nutrients in the ocean. Lightning struck and life began. Matter of fact, there was a couple of experimenters back in the 60s and 70s and the 50s that tried to do this. They took organic compounds and they ran electric currents through them, and they subjected them to ultraviolet light and radiation and all kinds of things that they thought were in the early atmosphere. And they were able to produce, after a couple of weeks, tar. And they said that tar was an organic compound. So they made tar. Now, you have to consider that this tar making was directed by an intelligence. Who was who? The men that were conducting the experiment. It just didn't happen randomly. It was directed. So even if they had created life, it would have been directed by a higher intelligence, which would not prove anything about evolution. Let me tell you about a theory that was very popular a couple of hundred years ago. And this was up until a couple of hundred years ago. This is spontaneous generation. Spontaneous generation, if you remember your biology books, said that life just sort of comes into being from inorganic dead matter. Back in the 1600s, 1500s, Middle Ages, the time of the apostles, people looked at a dead carcass on the road, and pretty soon they would see flies coming out of it. Or they would leave meat on the counter or vegetables, and pretty soon they would decay and flies would come out of it. So they said, oh, well, the meat, there's some kind of process where the meat is generating spontaneously this life. Now, they didn't realize that what was happening is the flies were coming, laying eggs on it. Then the legs, which were invisible, were turning into maggots. And then the maggots were turning into pupa, and the pupa were turning into the larva, and then they were becoming flies. If you put a piece of cheesecloth over the meat, no flies developed, because other flies couldn't get to it to see the meat. And this was spontaneous generation. A lot of people believe that worms and bugs and various organisms just kind of spontaneously generated themselves. And that's where life came from. Well, you remember Louis Pasteur? You've heard of pasteurized milk? That's his name, Louis Pasteur. And I'll tell you why milk was pasteurized in a minute. Let me read you what it says here about spontaneous generation. It's a theory that was developed many years ago. It said that living organisms develop from non-living matter. It was proven false by Louis Pasteur. Here is an excerpt of an address that Louis Pasteur delivered at the Sorbonne Scientific Soiree in 1864. Big scientific convention of all of the leading scientists of the day. And he says this about spontaneous generation. No, there is not a single known circumstance in which microscopic beings may be asserted to have entered the world without germs, without parents resembling them, which is a way of saying that like things bring forth like things. Does that sound familiar to you from anywhere? Without germs, without parents resembling them, those who think otherwise have been deluded by their poorly conducted experiments, full of errors they neither knew how to perceive nor how to avoid. So what Louis Pasteur did is he developed a bunch of experiments that showed that unless there was an organism that had touched it or come in contact with some kind of other substance, that nothing living could develop out of it. Germ theory, in other words. He was doing this not because he was interested in evolution and all that. He was trying to develop a way where wine would not spoil. And wine spoiled because of the microorganisms in the air. And these microorganisms settling on the wine, pretty soon you had moldy wine, which was no good. And the wine industry was losing millions of dollars because the wine spoiled. So he developed a way to make wine sterile. Pasteurized it. You've heard of pasteurized milk? Every time you drink a glass of milk, well, the carton of milk when your wife's not looking, every time you drink out of the carton of milk, you're proving that evolution doesn't work because that milk has been pasteurized. Now all the scientific experiments that we can conduct, all the biology books, all of the things I've told you about, all support the idea that spontaneous generation doesn't occur, that living things cannot come from inorganic matter, except for evolution. Because evolution says one time there was something dead, And over a process of time, and we throw in time because time is like a magic wand. If we have enough time, anything can happen. So we throw in all this time, and then we can now develop out of dead things, living things that have evolved into you and to me. Evolution violates the law of spontaneous generation, that dead things cannot produce anything living. There's another law, and this is the law of biogenesis. Bio means life. Genesis means beginning. So biogenesis says the following. This is out of the Wikipedia. Biogenesis is the production of new living organisms or organelles. The law of biogenesis, attributed to Louis Pasteur, is the observation that living things come only from other living things. You might say, so what? Well, back 300 years ago, that was a big step. They didn't realize that. That living things come only from other living things by reproduction. Example given, a spider lays an egg, which develops into spiders. That is, life does not arise from non-living things. This is summarized in the phrase, omni vivium ex vivio, which is Latin for all life is from life. A related statement is, omnius cellula est cellula. All cells are from cells. This observation is one of the central statements of cell theory. So if you're a biologist, if you're a microbiologist, there's a law that says that only living things can produce living things. Only like comes from like, is what that law is saying. Except for evolution. Evolution violates that law. It says that no, there was things that were dead, and over time, they were able to produce something living. So evolution violates the spontaneous generation that was found to be false, and it violates the law of biogenesis. Because if you look at evolution, it claims that living things came from dead matter. Here's the explanation that most evolutionists are going to offer you about life and how it began. And I think I gave you this explanation that I actually talked to a student about once. I may have mentioned this before, but it fits here too. Back when I was getting my degrees in biology, I was at the university cafeteria, eating lunch, minding my own business. And a student comes and sits down to me, and they all knew I was religious. He said, "Mendez, let me ask you a question." I said, "Yeah, what's up?" He said, "You don't believe in evolution, do you?" And I go, "No, I don't." He goes, "Well, why not?" And I said, "Well, I don't believe we have come from rocks." And the student goes, "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, evolution teaches we've come from rocks." He says, "No, evolution doesn't teach that. Evolution doesn't teach we've come from rocks." And I go, "Okay, well, let me ask you a question. Where did human beings come from?" Kind of giving you the gist of the conversation here. "Oh, well, the human beings came from the fossil man, Neanderthal man, and Australopithecines, and various other hominids. Okay, where did they come from?" "Oh, well, they came from the mammals, the early mammals. They evolved into man later, apes and monkeys. Okay, where did the mammals come from?" "Well, they descended from the amphibians. You know, some of the amphibians came from the sea." "All right, well, where did the amphibians come from?" I asked him. "Well, they came from the ocean, the fishes." "Okay, where did the fishes in the ocean come from?" "Well, they came from the single-celled organisms that were in the ocean." "I see." I said, "Well, where did the single-celled organisms from the ocean came from?" He said, "Well, there was this organic soup, and lightning struck this organic soup and began life, and these single-celled organisms evolved into the fish." I said, "Okay, where did this organic soup come from?" He said, "Oh, well, the waters washed over the rocks." And I said, "So you see, you believe that you've come from rocks." He didn't ask me any more questions after that. Let me read you what it says here. This is what evolutionists believe, very much like what he believed, the young man in my story. "Once upon a time," sounds like Star Wars, "once upon a time, a long time ago, life did not exist." This is the evolutionist story. "The waters washed over the rocks and created an organic soup. Lightning struck and life appeared. When a simple organism appeared, random mutations began their work of introducing variety so that in these organisms, the ones that had mutated, some began to adapt. The least fit died, leaving the more adapted to survive. We are the result of that process. Let's look at the simplest life form that scientists say exists on the earth today. That is the Mycoplasma gentilium. It is a little parasitic organism. It is 200 nanometers long. A nanometer is a billionth of a meter, which means it's very small, very small. It contains 482 genes. These genes can combine to make 500,000 base pairs, which is a DNA material. This is exceedingly complex. And this is a parasitic organism that lives on other larger organisms. So for this organism to exist, there had to be other ones on which it was feeding that were bigger. So this is the simplest one. Now, I have shown you here that living things can only come from living things. That's one of the laws, biogenesis. I've also shown you that spontaneous generation doesn't occur, and therefore living things can't come from dead things. Those are laws of science. Nobody disputes them except evolutionists. Let me ask you a question. What does the Bible say about where life has come from? Let's go to John chapter 1. John chapter 1. John chapter 1. John chapter 1. And in verse 1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. So we had Jesus Christ, the Word. He was with another God called God the Father. And Jesus Christ, who was the Word, was also God. So there was two gods. Verse 2, He, the Word, Jesus Christ, was in the beginning with the other God, God the Father. All things were made through Christ. And without Him, nothing was made that was made. In Him was life, and the life was the light of men. You know where I've gotten my life? From a long string of organisms that have gotten their life from Jesus Christ. So my life has come from the life giver, and your life too. See, our lives do not violate the law of biogenesis or violate the law of spontaneous generation. If you are a human being, God created you, so He imparted His life to you. So Christians and Bible-believing Christians do not violate these two laws, because they understand that God has given them life. Hebrews chapter 1. Hebrews chapter 1. Hebrews 1. We're talking about where does life come from, first point, and how evolution violates it. Hebrews chapter 1. Verse 2. He has, in these last days, spoken to us by His Son, whom He appointed heir of all things, through whom also He made the worlds, who being the brightness of His glory and the express image of His person, and upholding all things by the word of His power. Jesus Christ upholds all things by the word of His power. That includes living things. Jesus Christ is a powerful being. He has given us the power of being alive. Colossians, back 10, 15 pages. Colossians chapter 1. Verse 15. This is speaking about Christ. The context is Christ. Verse 15 is that He is Christ. He is the image of the invisible God the Father, the firstborn over all of the creation through the resurrection. I'm paraphrasing. For by Him, Christ, all things were created that are in heaven and that are on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or principalities of power. All things were created through Him and for Him. And He is before all things, and in Him all things consist. If Jesus Christ is the life giver, and He's the one that created us, we have our life force, so to speak, through Christ. So we are in support of the law of biogenesis. Not opposed to it. 1 Timothy chapter 6. Forward a couple of pages. 1 Timothy chapter 6. And notice verse 13. This is speaking about Christ. I urge you in verse 13 of chapter 6, 1 Timothy, I urge you in the sight of God, who gives life to all things. Where does life come from? From God. God gives us life. And then my favorite one, let's go to Psalms. Psalms 36. You ever been out hiking? It's hot. You're tired. You're thirsty. And you come upon a spring bubbling up out of the ground. Usually very clean, pure, pristine water. Some fountain coming up out of the rocks. Psalms chapter 36, verse 9. This is talking about God. For with you, God, is the fountain of life. All life, animal life, human life, all biological life was created by God, specifically Jesus Christ, and he empowers it all. And through his life, we are able to live. And that is in support of the laws that we've been reading about. Evolution violates that law. Evolution says, no. Things that we see now, they're living, they came from dead things, which is against all of these laws of science we're speaking about. So the first thing is that evolution violates the law of biogenesis, and evolution cannot explain where life came from. You and I have the answers where life came from, brethren. It came from God. Now, there's certain processes he used, but God is the originator of it. Second problem, scientific problem with evolution, is the abrupt appearance of species in the fossil record. The abrupt appearance of species in the fossil record. Let me give you one example. The Cambrian explosion, that's what it's called by paleontologists and biologists who study life in fossil strata. Cambrian explosion, according to Wikipedia, or less commonly the Cambrian radiation, was a relatively short evolutionary event beginning around 542 million years ago. Don't believe in the dates, but 542 million years ago in the Cambrian period. What happened? During which most of the major animal phyla appeared, as indicated by the fossil record. Lasting for about the next 20 to 25 million years, it resulted in the divergence of most modern Mesozoan phyla. Additionally, the event was accompanied by major diversification of other organisms. Prior to the Cambrian explosion, most organisms were simple, comprised of individual cells, occasionally organized into colonies, like paramecians and hydras, things like that. Over the following 70 to 80 million years, the rate of diversification accelerated by an order of many magnitudes, and the diversity of life began to resemble that of today. Let me read you the next paragraph. The Cambrian explosion has generated extensive scientific debate. The seemingly rapid appearance of fossils in the primordial strata was noted as early as 1840, and in 1859, Charles Darwin discussed it as one of the major objections that could be made against the theory of evolution by natural selection. In other words, I'm not quoting anymore. What Darwin said is, the animals have slowly changed over time. So in the fossil record, we're going to see all these variations of different organisms gradually changing. All right? And it's going to be a gradual process. And he said, we don't see that yet because I don't think we've dug up enough fossils. But if that doesn't happen, that means my theory is not correct. That's what he said. And that's what this author's saying. Let me read you this again. And in 1859, Charles Darwin discussed it, the Cambrian explosion, as one of the main objections that could be made against the theory of evolution by natural selection. The long-running puzzlement about the appearance of the Cambrian fauna seemingly abruptly and from nowhere. Now, if something appears abruptly and out of nothing, I call that creation. Isn't that what creation is? Abruptly and out of nothing? The long-running puzzlement about the appearance of the Cambrian fauna seemingly abruptly and from nowhere centers on three key points. Whether there was really a mass diversification of complex organisms over a relatively short period of time during the early Cambrian, what might have caused such a rapid change, and what it would imply about the origin of animal life. Interpretation is difficult due to a limited supply of evidence based mainly on an incomplete fossil record and chemical signatures remaining in Cambrian rocks. Now, let me tell you something, brethren. The strata, the fossils in the strata are not an indication of how things evolved. They're an indication of how things were buried. Right? Because some things can evolve without being buried. We had millions of buffalo roaming the plains in the 1800s. The buffalo hunters would go in there and kill them all, millions, and for miles there was nothing but bleached white buffalo bones. There are no beds of buffalo bone strata today. Why? Because the buzzards came, the animals came, cleaned it all out, the bones decayed. In order for you to have fossils, you have to have burial by water. So the fact that this is interesting, the fact that there's a Cambrian explosion and the fact that there's lots of fossils of it proves two things. There was a time when no animals existed because none were buried, and then all of a sudden we have all these animals and they're buried by some catastrophe. That sounds kind of interesting to me. Let me read you some more about the Cambrian explosion. More quotes. This is out of Genetic Regulation in the Fossil Record, American scientist James Valentine. The abrupt appearance of higher taxa in the fossil record has been a perennial puzzle. Not only do characteristics and distinctive remains of phyla appear suddenly, phyla is like animal groups, appear suddenly without known ancestors, but several classes of phylum, orders of a class, and so on, commonly appear at approximately the same time without known intermediaries. So the fishes evolve from the amphibians, and the amphibians evolve from the mammals evolve from the amphibians, and the amphibians evolve from the fishes in the sea. In the Cambrian explosion, they all appear at the same time, which is contrary to what evolution teaches. If we read the record rather literally, it implies that organisms of new grades of complexity arose and radiated, spread out relatively rapidly. I'm not going to read you the rest of the quotes. There's lots of them. This one is interesting. The solution to a jigsaw puzzle, this is Nature. Stefan Bengtson, what he wrote, he said this: if any event in life history resembles man's creation myths, creation is a myth. If any event in life's history resembles man's creation myths, it is this sudden diversification of marine life. In other words, he says the Cambrian explosion looks like one of the creation myths. Let me put it to you in plain English. God created everything at one abrupt time. There was catastrophes that came along and buried lots of organisms that didn't exist before, and that's what we're seeing in the fossil record. Evolution violates this because it says that animals have appeared gradually over time and that we should find all the intermediaries buried in different strata. That's not what we find in the fossil record. Third point, we're looking at the laws of science. Mutations are bad. They are not good. They cannot give rise to new organisms. Why am I saying this? Because evolutionists say that you have the genetic material in your body. And if the genetic material is not altered, you're going to have another human being that's just like the one before it, with variation. And this is going to continue on and on, so you're just going to get humans from the DNA, because the DNA is not changing. But if we have a cosmic ray that comes in, beep, knocks off a little bit of the DNA, or we have some chemical toxin that knocks off, beep, a little bit of the DNA, or maybe some of it doesn't repair itself and it hooks itself back up incorrectly, then we have a new organism. This is a mutation. And scientists say that mutations give rise to new organisms over time. There's only one problem. The vast majority of mutations are lethal. Those that are not lethal are detrimental to whoever's got them. Most of your chronic illnesses, conditions, are caused by mutations. Now, for a mutation to be beneficial, It must happen at the same time with other mutations. For example, if there's a mutation in your body, and this mutation in your body allows you to synthesize a hormone that you didn't have before, and this hormone is important in the development of this other object, well, the other object has to evolve and has to have a mutation to appear at the same time that the mutation for what drives it happens. So for mutations to work, they have to be beneficial, which are not, and they have to occur in sequence with others, which they do not. Evolution by mutations has been likened to a tornado going through an aircraft junkyard and putting a 747 together. And then scientists say, well, yeah, but see, evolution is sort of intelligent. So you have an intelligence behind it. Okay, let me change that around. How would you like a semi-intelligent mechanic to make adjustments to the mechanics of the 747 you're flying in? I wouldn't want that to happen. I'm just going to adjust here, and I'm maybe going to adjust here, and I'm going to adjust here. I'm going to take this out and put this in. Would you like that to happen to the airplane you're flying in? Not me. Because most of the time, what's going to happen? The plane is going to crash. Fourth point. So the third point is evolution uses mutations as its driving force, and mutations are detrimental. They do not make new organisms. They kill organisms. Number four, evolution violates the second law of thermodynamics. Let me define the second law of thermodynamics. You can go online and there's all kinds of definitions. I tried to pick out one that was kind of simple to understand. The second law of thermodynamics states that when energy is transferred, there will be less energy available at the end of the transfer process than at the beginning. What does this mean in plain English? Energy decreases as work is done. You know, I've done landscaping work, remodeling work, working at the university. And at the end of the day, I'm tired because energy's been expended. It's left the system. Energy decreases as work is done. That's the second law of thermodynamics. Things go from hot to cold, second law of thermodynamics. A system will become more disordered as time goes on, second law of thermodynamics. Less work can be done by a system, second law of thermodynamics. And my favorite, the light in the flashlight is going to grow dim after a while because the battery loses energy. Second law of thermodynamics. And then if you apply that to the universe is running down. It's running down. Now, all of the scientific experiments that we've done support the second law of thermodynamics. All of them say that things are going from an ordered state to a disordered state, except for one. Evolution says that we're going from simple to more complex. Now, what the evolution says, well, yeah, but see, we have an open system. The open system is that the sun is providing energy, and so evolution doesn't violate the second law of thermodynamics because it's getting energy from the sun. Well, that's not the problem, because if you take a brick and you put a brick on a sidewalk and the sun shines on it for 10 million years, it's not going to organize itself into something else, no matter how hot the brick gets. The problem is, someone has inputted a program into living things that makes it go from less organized to more. You can have a computer, the computer screen, the glass, the buttons, everything, the wires, everything hooked up together, and it's not going to work. You know why? You need a program. You need some kind of operating system. The operating system is more complex than the physical thing you're working with. So even if you had all the things that you needed, the right kind of carbon, the right kind of hydrogen, the right kind of whatever, if the operating system's not there, it's not going to work. Who put the information into the DNA? So the second law of thermodynamics violates that because in two ways. If the organism is increasing in complexity, that means somebody or something put the information in there to make it be able to make itself better, the DNA material we have. Why does a little baby turn into an adult that matures? Because of the information that's been put into the DNA. who put the program in there. So the law of the second law of thermodynamics is actually very much alive and well in the universe. Does the Bible support the second law of thermodynamics? It certainly does. Let's go to Romans chapter 8. Romans chapter 8. Romans chapter 8. And in Romans chapter 8, we're going to begin to read in verse 18. For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. For the earnest expectation of the universe, or the creation, eagerly waits for the revealing of the sons of God. Why is the universe waiting for us to be revealed? For the creation was subjected to futility. Some Bibles say vanity. Subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it in hope. Jesus Christ allowed the universe to become in a state of decay, because there was hope in the children of his children, the children of God, being available later to do what? Verse 20, for the creation was subjected to futility, second law of thermodynamics, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it in hope, because the creation itself also will be delivered from the bondage of corruption into the glorious liberty of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation groans and labors with birth pangs together until now. What this is saying in plain English is this, brethren. The universe has been put under the second law of thermodynamics, and it is slowly decaying. And the universe is waiting for the children of God to be born and groaning in pain. What happens after the millennium? There's a fill in the blanks. New blank and a new blank. New heavens and a new earth, wherein dwells righteousness. That universe is not going to be subject to the second law of thermodynamics. When is that going to happen? When the sons of God appear on the scene. So right now the universe is under the second law of thermodynamics. Isaiah chapter 40. The Bible says that all of the creation was allowed to be under the second law of thermodynamics. Isaiah, and we're going to look in Isaiah chapter 40. Now, you can say it in different ways. You know, you can say that the universe is running down, or you know, without God's power, the universe is going to decay. It means the same thing. I'm just putting it in scientific jargon. Second law of thermodynamics has been imprinted on the universe. Isaiah chapter 40, verse 26. Lift up your eyes on high and see who has created these things, who brings out their host by number, the host of the stars. He calls them all by name, by the greatness of his might and by the strength of his power. Not one is missing. Jesus Christ upholds all things. One more scripture on this theme, Revelation chapter 4. Revelation 4. Revelation chapter 4. Verse 11, you are worthy, O Lord, to receive glory and honor and power, for you created all things, and by your will they exist and they were created. Brethren, if it were not for the coming restoration of all things that's going to occur, the universe would run down. It would over a billions and billions of years. You know, it's going to take a little bit longer than the hour and a half to 2 hours. The flashlight's going to run down. But it's like a flashlight. Unless energy's put in it, it's going to run down. Scientists tell you that eventually, evolution and all of this stuff notwithstanding, that eventually the cosmos is going to be just a bunch of dark carbon atoms. Because that's all that's going to exist. No more energy, no more motion, no more nothing. And we know that this is going to change when the resurrection occurs and a new heavens and a new earth appears wherein dwells righteousness. So here's what I'm saying. The Bible supports the idea that the universe is under the second law of thermodynamics and that things are going from more organized to less. Evolution says, oh no, that's not true. We're going from simple to more complex. And all of the experiments that we do, all the physics, all the chemical experiments that we do, every experiment that we've done, none of them have ever violated the second law of thermodynamics. which says that things are running down. Never has ever been one. Yet evolutionists say that that's what happens when evolution occurs. So you tell me, who's being more scientific? We who believe in what we believe, or the scientists who believe that evolution violates all these laws? Remember I told you that God is a creator of nature? God didn't create evolution. It's going to violate the nature, the laws of nature. Fifth point is all species are fixed. All species are fixed. Variation, our microevolution, does occur, brethren. Let me rephrase that. Microevolution is simply a way of saying that there is variation. You have a bird. The bird is a sparrow. The sparrow can have a short beak or a long beak, some of them, depending. There's some people that are tall. There's some people that are taller than others. There's some people that are short. There's some people that are shorter than others. If you wanted to get people that had big feet, you just marry people that have big feet, and eventually your descendants are going to have big feet. But you're not going to have big. You're not going to have feet that are 12 feet long. There's a limit. It's been built in. Now, you laugh, but evolutionists don't believe that. Evolutionists believe that if you manipulate through animal husbandry and through genetic manipulation, that you can get organisms to slowly change over time. And pretty soon, you can create a new organism. Because they don't believe that there's limits. Let me read you what it says here. Darwin stated, you think I'm making this up, Darwin stated in the first edition of The Origin of Species, quote, "In North America, the black bear was seen swimming for hours with widely open mouth, thus catching, like a whale, insects in the water. Even in so extreme a case as this, if the supply of insects were constant, and if better adapted competitors did not exist already in the country, I can see no difficulty in a race of bears being rendered by natural selection more and more aquatic in their structure and habits, with larger and larger mouths, till a creature was produced as monstrous as a whale." You laugh because it's funny. This is a fairy tale that the evolutionists have. They believe over enough time, with enough small changes, that something can turn into something that it wasn't before. That's what evolution is in plain English. And the Bible says that that cannot happen. Now, think about microevolution. If you were a God, let's forget that part. If you were the designer of a car, and you were going to make a car and design a car, you're an engineer, you would make a car that had a heater. And you would also make a car that had air conditioning. Because you don't know if your car is going to be driven up north in Canada where you need a heater, or if it's going to be driven down south in Mexico where you need an air conditioner. So you would put the variety in there depending on what the organism needed later. So if you were God in the genetic material, you would put all kinds of traits that would serve all kinds of people that lived in different parts of the earth, depending on what they needed. That trait would be accentuated. So macroevolution, which is you go from the bear to the whale, does not occur. Microevolution, which is variety, does occur. But in microevolution, we have the same organism. It never changes in something else. Now, the scientists will tell you, well, yeah, you're being unfair, because humans are changing, but it takes hundreds of thousands of generations for them to change. And over time, they will become a new organism. Well, let me tell you something. There are bacteria. And bacteria can reproduce and make a new generation in a couple of hours, some of them. Most of them in a couple of days. So evolutionists and scientists, biologists, microbiologists, have studied bacteria for hundreds of years. And they've manipulated bacteria to try to make them become something different. And they have had hundreds of thousands of generations. And you know what? Still got bacteria. Still got bacteria. So they haven't changed into something else over hundreds of thousands of generations. They've just become bacteria. There's fruit flies. When I was a kid, I was a nerd when I was a kid, guys. When I was a kid, I did experiments with fruit flies. And you could cross fruit flies in little bottles. And fruit flies go from egg to adult in 9 days. And so you could make fruit flies that had different types of wings, different types of body size, different types of eyes, different types of coloring, and scientists have used fruit flies for the last 400 or 500 years. And they try to develop different traits of fruit flies. And they can. But they've never made anything more than a fruit fly. Even under directed manipulation, and we're going to mate this one with this one, you still get fruit flies. Now, if you get close to the limits of the fruit fly, you know what happens? Sterility. Let me give you an example. Perfect example of this is a mule. A donkey, which is in Spanish a burro, a Mexican word for donkey is burro. A donkey and a donkey can mate, and they can produce other donkeys. A horse and a horse can mate, and they can produce other horses. If you take a male donkey and a female horse, then you can make a mule. You produce a mule, but the mule is sterile. There are a few, in a few thousand generations, there are a few mules that are not sterile. But on the second generation, they're sterile. So all mules are produced by the mating of a donkey and a horse. The reason that they're sterile is because the kind limit is being reached. Let's go to Genesis chapter 1. Genesis chapter 6. Remember the story of Noah loading all the animals onto the ark? Genesis chapter 6. Notice how he loaded them. Genesis chapter 6. Verse 19. And of every living thing of all flesh, you shall bring two of every sort into the ark to keep them alive with you. They shall be male and female. Of the birds after their kind, of the animals after their kind, and of every creeping thing of the earth after its kind. What is a kind? Some people say it's a species. It's really not a species. It's more broad than that. Go to Genesis chapter 1. You remember I read you some of the quotes that said, you know, spiders only produce spiders, things like that? You'd say, that's pretty scientific. Notice in Genesis chapter 1 and in verse 20. Then God said, let the waters abound with the abundance of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the face of the firmament of the heavens. So God created great sea creatures and every living thing that moves with which the waters abounded according to their kind, and every winged bird according to its kind, and God saw that it was good. Verse 22, and God blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth, water in the seas, and let the birds multiply. So evening and morning were the fifth day. Verse 24, then God said, let the earth bring forth the living creatures according to its kind, cattle and creeping things and beasts of the earth, each according to its kind, and it was so. And God made the beasts of the earth according to their kind, cattle according to its kind, everything that creeps on the earth according to its kind, and God said it was good. You know what this is saying? Cats are going to give you cats. Dogs are going to give you dogs. There's no such thing as a dogat or a cog. They don't exist. If you take a lion and a tiger, you can get a liger, but then they're sterile. They can't produce anymore. You can't keep producing something and change it because it's sterile, because God has imposed limits. Because God said the kinds are going to bring forth after their kinds. The flying creatures are going to make other flying creatures like themselves. Brings up a very interesting concept, brethren. Notice verse 26. Then God said, let us, you and me, Christ, make man in our image. Who are we made after? What kind are we made after? The God kind. The God kind. We are made after the God kind. God said, let us make man in our image according to our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, over all the cattle, over all the earth, over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So God created man in his own image. We are patterned after the God kind, brethren. Now, if kind brings forth kind, and we are patterned after the God kind, what is going to be the end result of us? John chapter 1. John chapter 1. John chapter 1. We read parts of this before, but we didn't read all of it. Let's look at John chapter 1. And in verse 11, he came to his own. This is talking about Christ. And his own did not receive him. As a matter of fact, they crucified him. But as many as received him, have you received him, brethren? But as many as received him, to them he gave the right to become children of God. Brethren, it's fantastic, but we are patterned after the God kind. We are going to be children of God. That is what our destiny is. You know, we're not some evolutionary dead end. Enjoy life because after life this is all there is. No, we are patterned after the God kind. You remember God talking to the Pharisees and said, Satan is your father? That's where the children of the world are. They're of God, they're of Satan. Notice 1 John. 1 John, not John, but 1 John, right before Revelation. 1 John. 1 John. And we look at 1 John chapter 3. 1 John chapter 3. Verse 1. Behold, what manner of love the Father has bestowed on us, that we should be called the children of God. Therefore, the world does not know us, because it did not know him. Beloved, now we are the children of God, and it has not yet been revealed what we shall be. We don't exactly know what our end is going to be, but we know that when he is revealed, when he returns, we shall be like him, resurrection. For we shall see him as he is, because we will have spiritual knowledge and understanding, and we will be members of the spirit realm. You and I, brethren, have been fashioned after the God kind. God is making more of himself. Let's go to Revelation. You tell this to some people, they say, oh, that's blasphemy. Revelation chapter 21, second of the last chapter. Notice verse 3. And I heard a loud voice from heaven saying, behold, the tabernacle of God is with men. He will dwell with them, and they shall be his people. God himself will be with them and be their God. We're not going to go live with God. God is going to come live with us. Verse 4. And God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There shall be no more death, nor sorrow, nor crying. There shall be no more pain, for the former things have passed away. Then he who sat on the throne said, behold, I make all things new. And he said to me, write, for these words are true and faithful. And he said to me, it is done. I am the A to Z, the beginning and the end. I will give of the fountain of waters of life freely to him who thirsts. He who overcomes shall inherit all things, and I will be his God, and he shall be my son. It's kind of funny, brethren, that we don't understand this. But we sit in a church, and we call each other brothers. We talk about the church, which is the mother of us all. We talk about God the Father. We talk about being born again through the resurrection. We talk about the church, which is our mother, and Jesus Christ, our elder brother. Those are all familial terms. And God gives us a little taste of that when we're able to engender children. So what does that mean? It means that species are fixed. We are not animals, brethren. We are of the God kind. The animals are going to be patterned after their own kind. We are patterned after the God kind. In this sermon, we have seen how the theory of evolution violates many, many scientific principles. In our next sermon, we're going to see how the Bible is a better guide for understanding how the natural world operates and how evolution cannot account for the many forms of life that exist on the earth.